Now I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker. This is a guy that I had the opportunity to hear speak several years ago, and I run into him frequently when I go to conferences and other places. He does a lot of service work as well as, of course, some speaking. And I'm really inspired by his story, and I hope that you will be too. Please welcome Matt.
I'm Matt Graham, my alcoholic. I'd like to thank Bill for having me down here to Visalia to talk to you guys. My sobriety date is January 26, 1987. So if you're trying to add that up real quick, I'm 23 years sober. I did it because when I was new, these speakers would throw dates out, and I'd try to add it up real quick. And when you're new, you're not real good at thinking. And so I would take all these dates and stuff, and the next thing I know, they're saying the Lord's Prayer, and it's like I missed all the shit in between, you know. I'm 57 years old. I have 3 children and 4 grandchildren. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a relationship with all those kids and grandchildren today. That wasn't my first sobriety date. I did Alcoholics Anonymous my way for 12 years. And obviously it didn't work. I could get periods of sobriety halfway doing this. I could get 10 months sometimes, 11 months sometimes, you know. You know, you get the sponsor, but don't go to those meetings anymore because you might see them. In Fresno, we have a lot of meetings, so that's real easy to do. And you do 4 steps, but you leave certain things out because you can't look bad, you know. I just never worked. But the deal is I never had no problem admitting in the doctor's opinion that I had an allergy of the body and such of the mind. I knew when I took a drink in that I didn't have the choice of when I was going to quit. I absolutely knew that to be true, and I knew my life was totally unmanageable, ran by me of any sorts. There wasn't no doubt. There wasn't no doubt about that. But I didn't. The problem I have was I didn't have no willingness to do anything different. You know, you see, I wanted to die my whole life. I didn't know that in my younger years. I just knew that life sucked as a kid. I didn't never fit in. I was always shy. I felt like I had the wrong parents. I lived in the wrong town. I went to the wrong schools, you know. My dog was never as good as a neighbor's dog. You know, just everything in my life was always wrong. You know, our book in the doctor's opinion says we drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol, and I started out on Hot Thunderbird, so it wasn't for the taste of it, that's for sure. It's kind of hard thing. I just got back from Florida real late last night. I've been back there speaking. I've been back there for 6 days. And the time difference is 3 hours difference, and of course in Dallas the plane left real late, so I got back later than I was supposed to, so I got to bed California time 12:30 last night. So our keen thinking and stuff, you know, I still don't manage things real good. You know, I'm Mr. Superman, you know, and scheduled a doctor's appointment for first thing this morning, scheduled coming down here tonight. And I know how tough that is, being in Florida for 6 days and speaking 3 times, but I can do it, you know, and I'm just like really zombied out. But so where was I at? Oh, I was drinking hot Thunderbird. But you know, when and it was in the summer before the fourth grade. I didn't waste a lot of years. I was really pissed when I found out how good alcohol, when you guzzled alcohol, how everything that didn't fit in your life automatically, for me it wasn't glorious, but the things that didn't fit, it didn't matter anymore. That's what alcohol did for me. It just didn't matter anymore. It made everything okay. It didn't matter that, I had bleached blonde hair and I had freckles and that, I lived in this little hick town called Clovis and everybody rode horses and had horse shit all over their boots and stuff. It just didn't matter, And then I grew up in the wrong town. It didn't matter anymore. It wasn't that it was all great. You hear some speaker say, God, they took a drink and God, they became, Don Juan and everything was wonderful and they were the best looking guy around. That wasn't my case, but what alcohol did for me, it just made everything okay. It didn't matter. And I became a daily drinker from that day on. I don't understand people that drank on weekends only or just suffered through the day till they got off work so they could drink. Why would you fight that? I don't understand that. I mean, it only took me about 5 days before I became a morning drinker. It's like, why struggle to fight? I became a tough guy right away. The booze made it to where those kids that picked on me, I could whip their asses. And alcohol was magic to me. Everything that was wrong in my life, alcohol made it okay. And I could go to those school dances and ask the girls to dance. And if they said no, it was their loss, It didn't matter anymore. And I could go play baseball and I was the best. I wasn't afraid to swing the bat at the ball anymore. I mean, just everything in my life became okay to do. My parents were alcoholics and they got divorced when I was really young and before I started drinking and I never seen my parents and I wanted to blame my parents. It was their fault, and I started running the streets, from the third grade on, and it was my parents' fault. I never had adult supervision, and I was never showing no love. But you know what? I had some of my best friends had everything in the world given to them, and they ran with me. And I used to think, why don't you go home? You have everything handed to you, and some of my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, came from the best loving parents in the world and had everything in the world they wanted. The disease of alcoholism doesn't care what kind of families we came from. Right after I got sober, the medical profession proved that it was hereditary. And man, I wanted to run with that. It's not my fault. One more time, if I got one thing different than you, then I don't have to do what you do. If it's not my fault, there's no room for recovery. If I'm a victim, there's no room for recovery. And man, I wanted to run with that. It's not my fault, it's my parents' fault. And this old timer comes up to me and goes, boy, they call me boy all the time. I hate that shit. I'm a convict and a Hell's Angel, but I ain't no damn boy, and they call me boy all the time. And he says, boy, he goes, I've heard your story. I mean, what's that got to do with it? He goes, so you got a brother that's not an alcoholic, and I knew I was in trouble. And I go, yeah. He goes, what, did the mailman become his father or what? And I go, shit. One more time, I got to own my own alcoholism. It's not my parents' fault. I'm the one with the illness of alcoholism. And some people, a lot of people try to judge their alcoholism by other people's stories. And if you're fairly new here, I hope you don't judge your alcoholism by my story, because you'll probably end up dead unless God's not done with you. I'm the type that drinks and gets in trouble. I drink and break out in spots, all over, like spots, gels in Hawaii, gels in Mexico, and gels in Nevada. wherever I drink and go, I end up in jail. I'm the type that drinks and breaks the law. I'm the type that drinks and I want you to pay for the way I feel inside. I drink and make you pay for my pain. I want you to pay for my fears. And that gets me in a lot of trouble. And I drink and I like to shoot people. I was trying to think of a nice way to put that. But and what happens when you do that and you need to drink and do what you need to do when you're an alcoholic of my type is there's a lot of cops involved, so cops end up getting shot a lot when you're an alcoholic like I am. And that tends to get you in trouble. But I don't have enough time to go into all the stupid stories I've done. I've gotten the privilege of going all over the country, in Canada, Mexico, speaking all over. And it's not because I'm any authority of alcoholism. The stupider than you were as an alcoholic and got all these insane stories and live through it all, the more they ask you to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've gotten the privilege of getting to run all over the country and do that. But I ended up running in and out of a lot of institutions. You know, I started the juvenile hall system and I hooked up and with the Hells Angels, and I ended up getting my colors when I was 13 years old. And I was running with them started taking a lot of those things that we're not supposed to talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe in the singleness of purpose with all my heart. And I'm one of those that'll jump your ass if you identify as an addict in a meeting and you get called on and the secretary doesn't shut you up. That pisses me off more than anything in the world. I believe in the singleness of purpose more than anything, but I did. I also know the book talks about morphine. And I know it talks about sedatives, and I did a lot of that stuff. And I stuck needles in my arms, and if I knew I was going to be speaking in Visalia, California, when they offered me that stuff, I'd say, hell no, I've got to speak at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I can't have nothing but alcohol. But I did that stuff, and it became what happened from doing that. I love to drink. I love to drink more than anything in the world. And taking that other stuff, it made it possible so I could stay it for days and days and days. There's nothing better than seeing a couple weeks of closing time and never go home, you know. But it made it able to where I could take some stuff and go to sleep and then take some stuff to wake up and able to drink all day and be able to work, be able to function. I used to think I was a functioning alcoholic. It wasn't that. I took enough narcotics to be able to do that. That's all. But I drink all day long, no matter what. Except for when I was in the hole in the penitentiary. It's a little hard to get booze in there, but I ended up going into doing the hall a lot and then graduated to youth center and then CYA. And I wanted to go to jail. It's embarrassing when you're a Hells Angel and you go to juvenile hall. You know, I want to go to jail like real tough guys do. And I got, my dream came true. I turned 18, went straight to jail for an armed robbery and shooting a cop. And it's like, dang, man. I didn't mean to start off there, you know, and I beat those charges and I ended up getting married and she was supposed to be pregnant and that kid didn't pop out for 18 months and, you know. In my alcoholism, people were always doing me wrong, you know, and that was a pain in the ass doing that fourth step, and you get to that fourth column, and you know, what was my part in it? My part in it? And that part in the big book where it says, where did I put myself in a position to be harmed? Me? what happened is I ended up running in and out of a lot of institutions, and you know, for the violent crimes I was committing, they ended up sending me to a lot of lockdown psychiatric units evaluating me. They said I had to be insane for the violent crimes I was committing, and I don't know, most of you might know where Atascadero State Hospital is. When they first built that, it was for the violent, criminally insane, and right after it was open, they sent me over there. And they evaluated me, and we were so violent, and the crimes we were committing, like shooting cops and stuff like that, got you over there. In armed robberies, and you know, I kind of stole an armored truck one time, and... And I don't know, every time they locked me up, and they came out with the same evaluation there, but, and I don't know how they evaluate you there, because we could smoke in the institutions back then. We even got free cigarettes, but we were so violent we weren't allowed to have matches or lighters or anything. So what you would do is you'd get up every day and shuffle out to the day room, you know, and you'd sit down at the day table, and you get a cigarette out, and you're so low on Thorazine, you just try working the cigarette up to your mouth, you know, and somewhere throughout the day, you get that baby up in your lips, and in the back of the day room was this concrete wall, and it had this, you know, like a cigarette lighter, a round thing like that in the wall. And it was glowing red all the time, and you just shuffle up there and you try to aim for that hole, you know. And when you thought you were lined up, you just fell forward. And if you missed the hole, you smashed a cigarette and you had to go start all over again. If you made it in the hole, then you just went back and sat down, and you couldn't smoke. You just watched it like this, and ashes would fall off, and when the cherry fell off, you were done smoking, and you just got up and went to bed, you know. You were done. And I was there 4.5 months, and that's all I did was that and try to eat. You know, you just spill that food down the front of you and shit. But after 4.5 months of evaluation, they said I was incapable of adapting to a society way of life and homicidal. Now, how the hell they got that from trying to smoke that cigarette for 4.5 months? I don't know. I joined the Army. You know, I thought they would straighten me out when the Vietnam War is going on. And, I forgot about that. You know, they yell at you. Nobody yells at me. Nobody raises their voice at me. I'll shoot you. You do shit like that, you know. And so I get to four doors, and this guy's yelling at me, you know, and I get to think, you know, we should, like, drink and not think, or think and not drink, or something like that, you know, but not do both of them at the same time, drink and think, you know. And I was drunk as hell when we pulled on the four-door base, and this drill sergeant just screaming at me, you know, and I get to thinking, man, you know what? I ain't having this shit. And I get thinking, man, because I'm all the way on the back seat. I've never rode a bus before in my life. And, you know, Hell's Angels don't ride buses. But I get to thinking, if I can make it down this aisleway, and, you know, the steps go down, you know, and if I can muster up enough speed and stuff that I can probably one punch that guy and knock him out. And it worked really good. And I did. I knocked that guy out, but there was two gorillas behind him. And the first 10 minutes I'm in the United States Army, I'm in the stockade. I'm thinking, man, this was a bad decision, joining the United States Army. But, you know, it's really cool to get locked up every so often. You know, you get some rest for a couple of days. And I'm the type that I don't deal with nothing. Marriages, relationships, anything. I don't deal with nothing. I always cut and run. I don't deal with reality at all. And you know, I was there a couple of days, and it's time to leave. And they called it escape. It was just, it's just time to leave. That's when I left. The only thing I could find to get back to Fresno was that armored truck. They threw me in the federal penitentiary 6 months later when they found me. They threw me in the federal penitentiary and wartime backed anything but murder. The army would take you back out, and they took me back out, and they decided they didn't want me anymore, and they gave me a discharge, and well, life was just really sucking. And you know, I married the four women at this time. I haven't divorced any of them. And my life is slightly tipsy, out of control feeling, you know, and I just, you know, I don't know what to do, man. Nobody can help me. The jails can't keep me. The prisons can't keep me. The United States Army can't do anything to help me. I might as well just set out to make the world pay, and that's what I set out to do. And, you know, I can't die. And I started pulling guns on cops. And I wouldn't pull the trigger so they would shoot me. And I'd come through house surgeries and I'd still be alive. And it's like, damn. You know, I was 23 years old and went before the judge. And he made this offer to me. I could go back to prison for 2 years or go to AA 5 days a week for a year. And I couldn't make my mind up. So he gave me 5 days in jail to make my mind up. That's a tough decision, man. And I didn't make my mind up till I went before him, and I figured, well, I'd try that AA shit for a year. So I went to five meetings a week for a year, and I got my year medallion. You know, I didn't drink for 10 months. I figured it was close enough, you know. You know, but that guilt. No, Ned, I didn't do it for a year. I had to drink the night I took that year medallion. You know, because I knew it was a lie. And over the next years, you know, I didn't know till I got sober this time, why did I keep going back to AA? You know, because I wanted to die. But somewhere deep down inside, you know, I knew that was the only hope I had. But I did. I kept going back to AA. The suicide, the real serious suicide attempts started coming. If you could see my left wrist, you know, they say if you cut it both ways, that'll work. I've had plastic surgery down my arm. It still is mangled as shit. But someone came along and got me to the hospital just in time, right as I was bleeding out. And like I say, I was pulling guns on cops and not pulling the trigger and they'd shoot me, and the heroin overdoses and one motorcycle wreck I was in, you know, I went off a cliff, and you know, I just kept seeming to live through everything. And you know, I've been going to AA for 10 years and my seventh wife now, and you know, I had another ranch and a new Harley and a new Lincoln and the horses and all that crap and 50 employees and, you know, a ton of money in the bank, and everything looked really good on the outside. I've been wanting to die for a lot of years, and, you know, I ran her off, and she called and said she's going to split with this, I forget, some rock and roll guy she met so I could never see the kid. And I thought, I'm not going to let another wife do this. So I grabbed I'd been on about a 4 or 5 day run. I grabbed a shotgun and I stopped at 7-Eleven to celebrate blowing her head off. I bought 2 bottles of champagne and I went over her apartment and she wasn't home. Her neighbors were outside and they knew how insane I was. I'd been locked up a lot and, you know, it didn't matter. I kicked the door in and I'm guzzling that booze and taking some other stuff, and the SWAT team shows up, and I don't know why. I can't go out and shoot another cop. I just can't do it no more. And I get to thinking my kids would be better off without me in this world, and I stuck that shotgun in my head and I pulled the trigger. And when I came to out of that coma months and months later, I was all the way blind, still most of the way blind. This is just a big blur, but I was all the way blind then, and I have this plate that fits inside my head. If I pulled this out right now, I still can't talk, but I didn't have a plate in there then, and so much of my face was missing. This is like hundreds and hundreds of major surgeries put me back together. So it was a big hole in my head, and I had tubes sticking out of me everywhere, and every part of my body was strapped down with leather restraints so I couldn't wiggle or move or anything. And like I said, I couldn't talk, and I was hooked to life support systems, and doctors would come in every day and tell me, boy, there's nothing we can do for you, you're going to die. And that's where I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous again. People from AA doing service work would come up there, and they'd knock on the door, and they'd come sit down in the chairs next to me, and they'd ask me, you know, can we read you the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? Like, I had a choice in this matter, you know. And they take turns reading me that book all day long. And when they leave it, and they did it day after day, week after week, month after month, and what they did was they bought a tape deck up there with all these tapes. And when they leave at nighttime, you put a tape out, they'd say, you want to listen to speaker tape? Like, I could say yes or wiggle my head, yes, I couldn't. And they put a tape on, and the nurses, you know how they check your vital signs all night long? Every hour? Well, when the tape would end, they thought, I enjoyed it, so all night long they put a different tape on. So I don't know how many hundreds of speaker tapes I heard all those months and months and months that I was in the hospital, and I finally lived through it. And people go, you want to go to AA meeting? And I mean, I made the national news what I'd done, and so I'm blind. And so I know people are going to be out to get me now for everything I'd done, and all the people I'd shot, and tell you, I want to go there. I want to hide out in AA. As many means as you got, I'll go. I mean, I'm going to 3 to 5 meetings every day. I got the sponsor. I'm working steps. I'm doing service work. I'm doing the whole deal this time. But you see, I got a secret, though. People are asking me, man, you're doing so good, Matt. Isn't sobriety great? And I go, man, this is the greatest thing in my life. I don't know why I didn't do all this stuff before. This is awesome. And I drank 3 times in the next 2 years. After a meeting, the late night meeting, I drank, and I'd be back to the meeting next day. I didn't tell nobody I drank those 3 times. Nothing happened. I just drank. And I didn't tell nobody I drank. I didn't tell, the secret was, I didn't tell nobody how desperately I was going to die, and I was saving all my pills as many as I could from the surgeries, because there was going to be a day I had to check out this world. Because this AA really sucks. Being alive really sucks. And I'm going to meetings every day. I'm doing service work. Man, this is awesome. I'm actually speaking around and speaking in llama clubs and stuff, man. And this is awesome. But I got a secret. And after 2 years of that shit, I took 455 synthetic morphine tablets. And I guzzled them down with 2 half gallons of vodka. When I came to out of that coma, I was really pissed. It's like, what I got to do to die? And it came to me that there must be some kind of God that they've been talking about, that if he's not done with you, you're not going to die. And I believe that with the bottom of my heart today, that there is a God. And if he's not done with you, you can do whatever you want, and all you're going to do is keep missing body parts, but you won't die. And I believe that 100%. Because I've done everything in my power to seriously try to die. And all I did was kept missing body parts. I mean, my whole body's been pieced back together and pins and screws and plates. And well, I got one original part left. I think if I keep drinking, I'm going to lose that sucker too, you know. And, it's like, I never believed in God. I was never one of those in jail that said, okay, God, you get me out of this jail. I thought those were weak people to even believe in God or do that born again shit in jail and then get out and do differently. I never, ever prayed to God. I never believed there was a God. I never nothing. I believe what the book says, deep down inside every man, woman, child is born with a fundamental idea of God. I believe that today to be true. But I never once in my life ever mentioned the word God. All those years in AA, when they said the prayers, I would say the prayers, but I would leave the word God out. But that morning when I came to, it was a cussing prayer, and I believe that God understands that we're doing the best we can, and he understands. And he doesn't hold us against us, and I believe that was the bottom of my heart. You know, it was a cussing prayer, but basically I'm not going to say the same prayer because I don't pray that way today, but basically what I did was I told God that, you know, whatever he wanted me to do and whatever he asked me to do, I'll do it. I'm done fighting. And I went to the meeting that day. I told old timers what had happened, and I would do whatever God and them asked me to do. And I said, "So what do you want me to do?" And they started that boy shit again. And you know, my sponsor used to call me boy, and I told him, "You know, you keep talking until I can find you, and I'll whip your ass." And you know, he would give that silly ass laugh he has, and then he'd move, and I couldn't find him. He used to just piss me off, you know. But they said, "Boy, we want you to go out and pick up the cigarette butts." And I go, "This circus act ain't happening, man. We're not going to gather at the window and watch a blind boy try to find the cigarette butts." He said, "We thought you said you would do anything." I go, "Okay." And you know what? That worked over 23 years ago, so I still pick up the cigarette butts. I'm not one of those that gets a bunch of years around here and say, "Hey, I leave that shit for the newcomers to do." You know what worked in the beginning? I believe that Bill and Bob wrote this stuff, and nowhere in our literature does it say, "Okay, you're sober at this amount of sobriety and this amount of working the steps and service, leave that for the newcomer to do." It doesn't say that in any of our literature. I believe whatever worked in the beginning, we're to continue doing that to the rest of our sobriety. It says continue our spiritual maintenance. So I believe I'm to do what I did in the beginning of my sobriety still today, and I still do that. And 5 days sober, I've had a service commitment every day of my sobriety since I've been 5 days sober. And 5 days sober, they told me, "Boy, we need to go to the jail, take the meeting to the jail. It's not being covered." I go, "I got warrants for my arrest. I ain't doing it." And they said, "Boy, we thought you made a deal with God that you would do." I go, "Well, I got warrants for my arrest." And they go, "We don't give a shit." Back then, they didn't need clearances or anything, thank God. You just went up and said, "Hey," and they let you in. I was scared I wasn't getting out of that jail that night. It's February 1st of this year. Has been 23 years I've been going in, and I'm the coordinator of that jail. I still go to the meetings there. God hasn't sent me a fax and said, "You know, you've done enough. Don't go anymore." I still go. You know, I was bred tonight, the intense working with others, you know, and I still do that. Mark drove me down here, and he's one of my sponsees, and he's 3 years sober now, and we've been a lot of places together, you know. I mean, the book says we build friendship and fellowship, and I enjoy being around him. Yeah, I'm a sponsor, but I love that guy to death, and we've been a million, and did I like him in the beginning? When he asked me to be a sponsor, I thought he was an arrogant prick. I did not want to sponsor him. I thought, when he asked me, I looked up and thought, "God, you must really be pissed at me." And I love that guy more than anything in the world today. You know, when Bill asked me to come down here, Mark's the first one I called and asked him if he'd give me a ride down here. I love that guy to death, man. And Mary's here tonight. I sponsor her now. And I usually don't talk about that sponsoring women. I do. And some of you are going to have some asshole opinions about that. Talk to someone else. I don't want to hear it. She's become a joy in my life. She's a pain in the ass too, but you know, I love it when she calls. And you know, that sponsoring has been an absolute joy in my life. It's been a heartache in my life, you know, because you learn to love these people. And I've had a lot of sponsees over the years die sober. There was a guy here in Visalia that I sponsored for a long time named Kelly Dock that I sponsored, and I love that guy dearly, and he died sober here about 3 years ago, something like that. And another guy I sponsored for 16 years, whatever it was, he died about 3 years ago, a convict guy. And you know, it was real hard for me to get really close with someone because of all the people I lost in my life. And he died 3 years ago, and I swore I wasn't ever going to get that close to another sponte ever again. I wasn't going to endure that pain and shit no more. I was never going to get that close, and Mark came along, and Mark's taking Jerry's place. I tried and tried not to get close. I wasn't going to get that close, and one of the other girls I sponsor has 20-something years. Mark and her are like, I love them both. I mean, I sponsor probably 40 people, but Mark and Debbie are the two blessings of my life that are absolutely awesome. You know, I do a ton of service, you know, and I've been involved in just about every kind of service there is. You know, I asked my sponsor in the beginning, what kind of service do you think I belong in? And he says, someone like you, as sick as you, needs to try it all and see where you fit. And I've done just about everything. You know, I love H&I the best, but, you know, I've done the general service thing. I did that for 5 years. You know, I was on the board of our central office for a lot of years. I was the intergroup chair for 6 years. You know, I've been on conference committees at least two a year, probably for 20 of my 23 years of sobriety. And, you know, I've just done a lot. I was on public information for a lot of years. You know, I've just been involved in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot. Now, does everything go really great? I thought, man, once you're sober, nothing bad will ever happen again. That's not true. Life goes on. I mean, amazing. It says in chapter 11, great events will come to pass for you and countless others. That's absolutely true. But life goes on, man. Then my parents have died in sobriety. The doctors performed the wrong surgery on my pride and joy little boy, my youngest child, that I ended up getting 100% custody of in sobriety. How does a convict, Hell's Angel like me, get 100% custody? Because I practiced these principles in all my affairs. It blew me away when I got 100% custody in sobriety. They performed the wrong surgery on him when I was 9 years sober, and they told me, you know, surgery after surgery, hospital after hospital, 3.5 months worth of that stuff, and twice they told me he wouldn't make it through the night. That was tough. You know, I got married once in sobriety. It ended up being the worst divorce in my life out of 8 marriages. And the only thing I can tell you out of that, I'm not going to sit up here and tell you everything she did to me through that divorce, why it was so nasty. The book says, where did I set myself in a position to be harmed? And I did. And that's all I can tell you out of that divorce. Through that, I thought was the worst nightmare of my life. I met the best love of my life. I wasn't ever going to take a girl. I wasn't going to sit next to a girl in a meeting ever again. I wasn't going to take a girl on a panel. I was going to tell all the girls I sponsor to screw off. I won't sponsor a girl ever again. I wasn't going to nothing with another lady ever again. I was being a smart ass, speaking at conferences, actually saying I'm accepting resumes for my 9th ex-wife. And I was speaking up north, and this 5-foot-tall, 98-pound, long blonde, little tiny girl came up and said she had a resume for me. And I never fell in love with a girl like that ever in my life, and she fell in love with me, and we were together 4.5 years, the most awesome relationship I've ever had in my life. And I was gone back east speaking, and she went for a doctor's appointment. And the doctor put her in the hospital because the small on her neck looked bad. And 5 days later, she was dead with melanoma cancer. And I was really, really pissed with God. And I went in and I wrote for 6 hours. I started out, I told God how screwed he was and how much I hated him. And I wrote for 6 hours till I get to the point where I thank God. You know, I apologize to God at the end of that. And I realize that when a tragic thing happens to me in sobriety, I'm probably always going to cuss you out first, but I promise I'll do the work and the writing to where I could get to where I thank you for the joy you put in my life over this. And that was the most amazing relationship ever in my life. But so there's a lot of good things, man. You know, I knew there was a kid out there. I didn't know whether it was a boy or a girl. And through my men's steps, through some series of events, I found this child, and it ended up being a girl. And ended up, her mother ended up being sober a year longer than me. That pissed me off. But me and that daughter have an awesome relationship today. She has two of my grandchildren. The sad thing is her mother quit going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And at 16 years sober, 8 years of not going to meetings, she committed suicide. It's a sad, sad thing. I see it a lot of times. People quit going to meetings and commit suicide sober. It seems like it would be so much easier to keep going to meetings and keep doing what I do. So, you know, life keeps going on. You know, bad things will still happen, but God gives us a way to get through this, to still have emotional sobriety. You know, when I was gone in Florida, that's one of the talks I got to do with the sickest man in AA called Wayne Butler. We did a workshop Saturday at the conference on emotional sobriety. And Wayne read that letter that Bill wrote for a, you know, emotional sobriety, the new frontier. And that, you know, if we do what we're supposed to be doing in Alcoholics Anonymous on a daily basis, we can walk through any tragedy, any awesome thing that happens in our life, we can walk through both of them with dignity and grace, man. If we're doing what we're supposed to be doing for God on a daily basis in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm out of time, but I just want to thank you guys for having me down here. I hope I didn't bundle this so bad because I'm all over the place. But I want to thank Bill again for having me down here. God bless you guys. Thanks.